imagine engineering the perfect steel structure. You know, you've calculated all the thermodynamics, you've modeled the kinetic growth of the internal microstructures down to the exact atom.
Right, you've basically got the perfect blueprint.
Exactly. And the math guarantees you this specific, highly predictable material strength. But then you drop the temperature.
Yeah.
And instead of following your pristine mathematical model, the microscopic components of your steel, they literally just stop cooperating with each other. The internal architecture just, it gives up.
It really is, you know, the ultimate reality check for any material scientist. I mean, we map out these brilliant mathematical blueprints of how alloys should behave,
Yeah.
and we just tend to assume those the equations govern the material completely.
That the math is the absolute law.
Right. But physical reality, especially at extreme temperatures, just really doesn't care about our math.
Which is exactly what we're exploring today. Welcome to this custom deep dive designed specifically for you. Today, our mission is to unpack a highly focused, dense academic paper from the journal Materials, Science, and Technology.
Yeah, this was published back in 2015.
Right. It's titled Perlite Growth Rate in FEC and FMNC Steels by SWCO and a really dedicated team of researchers. And while a niche metallurgy paper might sound intensely specialized, hidden inside this abstract is just a massive scientific collision between theoretical math and microscopic reality.
It's a phenomenal case study. I mean,
Yeah.
to really appreciate the landscape here, you just have to look at the other research published right alongside it in that issue.
Oh, for sure.
You're seeing topics like spheroidization of superbainite or broken bainite. There's nuclear growth and, you know, mathematical modeling of surface hydrogen.
Yeah.
This is really the bleeding edge of material science.
Yeah, we are talking about the foundational alloys here, binary and ternary steels, that basically form the backbone of modern infrastructure.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we can understand the mystery that Seo and the team uncovered, we have to establish the physical baseline, right? The paper starts by detailing a kinetic theory for the growth of perlite in two types of steel.
Right, so you have a simple binary steel, which is just iron and carbon, and then a ternary steel that adds manganese into the mix.
Yeah. And for you listening who already knows your materials science, we know perlite isn't a single phase. But what is physically happening during this growth?
So perlite is a lamellar structure. It's basically a microscopic layered cake of two different phases. You've got ferrite, which is essentially pure iron, and cementite, which is an iron carbide compound.
Okay, so a layered cake of iron and iron carbide.
Right. And when the parent phase, which is called austenite, cools down, it can't hold all its carbon anymore. It's like it's overstuffed.
So it has to eject it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The ferrite rejects the carbon, the cementite absorbs it, and they grow together in these alternating, really cooperative layers.
Wow. Okay. And the researchers built this highly sophisticated mathematical model to predict the speed of this layered growth. The abstract notes that the model ensures local equilibrium at the transformation front with austenite.
Yeah, that's a key phrase there.
Right. And they also specifically highlight that the math accounts for both boundary and volume diffusion of solutes. So I want to conceptualize this diffusion because it's essentially about how the carbon and manganese atoms are, you know, traveling to get out of the way,
Pretty
right?
much, yeah.
So if we think of the steel as this massive, tightly packed stadium crowd, the transformation front is the gate.
Okay, I like that.
Right. So boundary diffusion would be the people, like the carbon atoms, sneaking along the outer walls where there's less resistance. And then volume diffusion would be people trying to push their way straight through the dense middle of the crowd.
That stadium analogy is a decent starting point for visualizing the pathways, definitely. But we have to add a really critical layer of physical friction here.
Okay, what kind of friction?
Well, in steel, those people aren't walking through empty space. They are atoms forcing their way through a dense, solid iron crystal lattice. The resistance is just immense. Yeah, so volume diffusion requires a massive amount of thermal energy because the carbon atom actually has to physically squeeze between the iron atoms within that crystal structure.
That sounds incredibly difficult for the atom.
It is. Boundary diffusion, on the other hand, takes advantage of the grain boundaries. Those are the disordered microscopic seams between the crystals where there's literally just more physical space to move.
Okay, so the math has to account for both of these pathways because the atoms will just take whatever route the temperature and the energy levels allow.
Exactly. And it gets exponentially more complicated with the ternary steel, the one with manganese.
Why is that?
Because carbon is an interstitial element, meaning it's small enough to squeeze between the iron atoms. But manganese is a substitutional element. It's roughly the same size as iron.
Oh, so it can't just squeeze through.
No, not at all. For manganese to diffuse, it literally has to wait for a vacancy, like an empty spot in the lattice, to open up and then swap places. It is orders of magnitude slower than carbon.
So for CO's kinetic theory to actually model the growth rate accurately, the equations had to balance the rapid darting of carbon with this incredibly sluggish, creeping movement of manganese across both the boundaries and the volume.
Yes. And according to the paper, they totally nailed it.
They did. Under normal conditions, their mathematical model was a massive success. They write that they observed good agreement with published experimental data.
Right. Which means the math predicted exactly how fast the perlite layered cake would grow. And the physical steel matched those equations perfectly.
That's got to feel pretty good as a researcher.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if we connect this to the bigger picture, that good agreement is the absolute bedrock of engineering confidence. When your kinetic theory accounts for both types of diffusion and perfectly matches the real-world growth rates, you basically assume you've mastered the thermodynamic rules for those alloys.
You trust the model completely.
Exactly. You trust it to tell you how the steel will behave without having to run a physical test every single time.
But then the blueprint completely shatters.
It really does.
And because their confidence in this kinetic theory was so high, the anomaly they hit is just glaring. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
The researchers noticed a massive discrepancy when they looked at data from extreme environments. The paper states that at the lowest of temperatures, the reported growth rate of the perlite was much, much smaller than their kinetic theory predicted.
Right. And it wasn't just a minor deviation. We're talking a huge gap. A mathematical model predicted the steel should be transforming at a robust speed, but the old published experimental data they were comparing it against said it was happening at a fraction of that rate.
So the map and the territory were in direct contradiction.
Exactly.
Let's dig into the thermodynamic tug of war here. Because when you drop the temperature of steel, you are increasing the supercooling, right?
Yes.
You're creating this massive thermodynamic driving force that is basically screaming at the austenite to transform into perlite. The urge to change is just huge.
That is the paradox of it all. The colder it gets, the more unstable that high temperature austenite becomes. So the thermodynamic push to transform is incredibly strong.
Okay.
But simultaneously, the kinetic energy, which is the heat required to actually move those carbon and manganese atoms through the lattice plummets.
Yeah.
So the driving force is slamming on the gas pedal, but the sluggish diffusion is slamming on the brakes.
And the mathematical model assumed the gas pedal would win out, or at least that it understood how to balance the two. But the old data said the brakes just locked up.
Exactly.
Now, when you are a researcher who just built this elegant, comprehensive kinetic theory that works perfectly everywhere else, do you immediately assume your math is fundamentally broken? Or do you suspect that the old published data from those extreme, difficult-to-measure freezing temperatures was just flawed?
See, this raises an important question about the rigor of the scientific method. The temptation to just brush off the anomaly is huge. It's incredibly easy to say, well, the old measurement equipment from decades ago must have been poorly calibrated at low temperatures, so our new math is fine.
Right. Honestly, I would be so tempted to just write a footnote citing probable measurement error and move on with my perfectly clean equations.
A lot of people would, but Seal and the team did the exact opposite. They didn't adjust their math to force a fit. And they didn't arrogantly dismiss the old literature either.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. The abstract explicitly states experiments were conducted to replicate the published data. They went into the lab and physically recreated the extreme supercooling themselves. They respected the anomaly enough to actually test it physically.
And their lab work confirmed the unthinkable. The old data was entirely accurate.
It was spot on.
By running the physical experiments themselves, they proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that the growth rate of the perlite truly was crawling at those freezing extremes. The mathematical model was officially broken.
Yeah. But by confirming that physical reality, they could finally stop debating the math and start investigating the actual atomic behavior. They had to figure out why it was slowing down.
Right, which requires a complete shift in scale. You have to stop looking at the macroscopic growth rate equations and zoom in on the microscopic architecture at the transformation front.
Exactly. You have to ask, what physically changes between the ferrite and the cementite when thermal energy drops that low?
And this is the major breakthrough of the paper. They discovered the root cause was a literal breakdown in teamwork. The abstract notes, It is found that the cooperation between cementite and ferrite breaks down at these temperatures.
Yes.
We talked earlier about perlite being a cooperative, alternating layered cake. I want to picture this like a dual extrusion 3D printer laying down two different materials simultaneously to build a single object.
That is a much more accurate mechanistic way to look at it, actually.
Right. So under normal temperatures, the 3D printer is just humming along. One nozzle is laying down ferrite, which is simultaneously rejecting carbon over to the second nozzle, which is laying down the cementite.
Yeah, perfectly coupled growth front.
Exactly. But when the temperature drops to an extreme low, the physical environment changes. The thermal energy required for the carbon to diffuse, to physically jump from the ferrite nozzle to the cementite nozzle, gets too low.
The carbon pathway just clogs up.
Yes. The cementite is starved of the carbon it needs to grow, while the ferrite is choking on the carbon it can't get rid of. The dual extrusion process completely fails.
It falls apart.
So what does this all mean? When that synchronization breaks down, what actually happens to the physical structure of the steel?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the entire morphology changes, because the ferrite and cementite can no longer share carbon efficiently enough to grow as parallel layers.
Yeah.
The coupled growth front collapses. Yeah, the perlite literally cannot form its characteristic lamellar structure. The model failed because the MAV assumed that cooperation, that coupled boundary condition, was a permanent, unbreakable rule of the alloy. It assumed the 3D printer would always use both nozzles.
So the model didn't account for the fact that extreme cold wouldn't just slow down the printing, it would fundamentally change the printing process itself.
Exactly, and it completely reframes how we view these alloys. It proves that the ferrite and cementite aren't just independent phases that happen to grow next to each other. They are a highly interdependent chemical system.
And severe environmental shifts can just sever that dependency.
Totally.
But discovering that the cooperation breaks down introduces a massive new problem for the researchers, right? Because in material science, discovering what went wrong is only half the battle.
Oh, for sure.
If the steel is no longer forming perlite, well, it is forming something else.
Yes, you are left with a structural void in your data. If the material stops behaving the way it's supposed to and stops forming the structure it's supposed to form, the burden of proof is on you to definitively identify what transformation product has taken its place.
And arguably, you have an even harder job, which is that you have to definitively prove what it has not become.
Right.
Which brings us to the final, incredibly rigorous act of this metallurgical detective story. The researchers had to verify the true identity of the resulting structure caused by this breakdown in cooperation. And the abstract explicitly states they needed to prove that the product was not bainite,
which is the obvious prime suspect. If you recall the surrounding journal topics we discussed earlier, like spheroidization of superbainite or broken bainite is a major complex structural variation that forms in steel at lower temperatures.
Okay. So if perlite fails to form because it's too cold, the entire metallurgical community is going to instantly assume, oh, the temperature dropped, so it just transformed into bainite instead.
Exactly. And if it is bainite, then CO's discovery isn't actually a new phenomenon of broken perlite cooperation at all. It's just a standard, well-documented transition to a completely different phase.
So they have to clear bainite's name. They have to rule it out completely.
They do?
To do that, the abstract says they utilized surface relief experiments. Now, I want to make sure we explain exactly how this works, because it sounds like forensic science, you know, dusting for fingerprints on a microscopic piece of metal. But it is deeply rooted in the crystal lattice structure. How does looking at the surface of the steel tell you whether or not the inside is bainite?
It comes down to the fundamental difference in how these structures grow at the atomic level. Mm-hmm. Perlite growth, even when it breaks down, is a reconstructive transformation.
Reconstructive, okay.
Right. The iron and carbon atoms are unbinding, diffusing, and rebuilding themselves atom by atom into a new lattice. Bainite, however, involves a displacive transformation.
Displacive meaning it physically shears or shifts the existing structure.
Exactly. In a displacive transformation, a whole massive block of atoms suddenly shears and shifts its shape simultaneously. It's almost like a microscopic earthquake within the metal.
Whoa!
Yeah, and when that subsurface shearing happens, it pushes up against the boundary of the material. It causes a physical, measurable displacement, like literal microscopic tenting or ridge on the polished surface of the steel.
That is brilliant. So a surface relief experiment isn't just looking at the steel. They're using atomic force microscopes or interferometry to actually map the microscopic topography of the surface.
Right.
They're looking for those specific jagged mountain ridges that prove a displacive shear took place.
Precisely. If they measure the surface and find that displacive tenting, the suspect is bainite. But if the surface remains relatively undisturbed, showing only the volume changes associated with atoms slowly rebuilding themselves, then no shearing took place.
And if no shearing took place, it is physically impossible for the structure to be bainite.
Exactly.
And the researchers ran these topographical measurements. They mapped the microscopic wreckage of that broken cooperation, and they found no displacive surface relief.
None at all.
They proved it was a reconstructive failure, not a displacive shear. They definitively ruled out bainite.
Which perfectly illustrates the exhaustive, almost punishing burden of proof required in high-level scientific literature. I mean, you cannot just publish a paper claiming you found a novel breakdown in perlite cooperation at low temperatures.
Because everyone will just doubt it.
Right, you have to anticipate the immediate skepticism of your peers, who will all just scream, "It's just bainite!"
Yeah. And by rigorously conducting those surface relief experiments, Seo and the team closed the loop. They made their findings airtight. They didn't just point out a mathematical failure, they physically replicated it, found the microscopic chemical mechanism behind it, and then explicitly mapped the boundaries of the resulting structure.
It adds a highly precise, uncontested piece of knowledge to the field of materials algorithms.
It really does.
It's a masterclass in the scientific method. You start with a theoretical model, you test it against extreme physical reality, and when reality breaks the model, you don't retreat. You dive into the physics of the failure until you understand the material better than you did when your math was supposedly perfect.
Let's zoom out and recap this journey for you, because we have covered some incredibly dense metallurgical ground today. We started with a highly confident kinetic theory, a mathematical blueprint predicting the exact growth rate of perlite in binary and ternary steels.
Right, a model that accounted for both boundary and volume diffusion and matched to the real world perfectly.
Perfectly, until it hit an absolute mathematical wall at the lowest of freezing temperatures. But instead of dismissing the anomaly as bad data, the researchers physically replicated the extreme cold in the lab.
And they discovered that the sluggish thermodynamics caused a literal breakdown in the cooperative dual extrusion growth between cementite and ferrite.
Yeah. And finally, they utilized microscopic topographical mapping, those surface relief experiments, to prove the resulting uncooperative structure didn't shear the lattice, definitively ruling out bainite.
It is a beautifully complete narrative of discovery. And for you taking this in, the relevance of this deeply specific materials science abstract extends far beyond the metallurgy lab.
How so?
Well, it's a powerful empirical reminder that no matter how comprehensive our mathematical blueprints are, and no matter how perfectly our theoretical models map the world under normal conditions, physical reality will always have the final say.
Right, the environment can always force a physical change in behavior that the theoretical equations just never saw coming.
Absolutely. The model assumes continuity. Nature does not guarantee it.
Which leaves us with a final lingering thought for you to take away and explore long after this deep dive ends. We started by talking about an engineered steel structure and how the mathematical assumptions of its strength hold up perfectly until you push the temperature to the extreme, causing the internal atomic cooperation to literally seize up. If a simple drop to the lowest of temperatures can completely shatter the microscopic teamwork inside something as seemingly solid, static, and invincible as steel, what other established foundational models in our world might quietly break down if we just push the environment a little colder or a little hotter?
It really makes you wonder how many other perfect scientific blueprints are just waiting for the weather to change to reveal their hidden breaking points.
It certainly does. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the microscopic mysteries of steel. Keep questioning the blueprints.